Mr. Hall, room 3.
We sailed south, and our next port of call was Cape Town. But probably I should say a word about life on board the troop ship.
Yes.
For many of the other ranks, as we were called, this would be their first experience of class-divided society in reality. The top deck was out of bounds to other ranks, although some of us did wander onto the top deck. We had on board people with a white tab. They had been selected, although not trained. They were going out to officer training in what later we knew to be India. But the conditions on board ship, the food was excellent. It was a spotless ship. Our deckhands were Chinese. It was a Canadian Pacific boat. The galley people were, I think the chief cook was a Liverpool man. The engineers were Scots or Canadians. But what was noticeable was the relatively spacious accommodation for officers and the cheek by jowl accommodation for the other ranks. I was on a lower deck, below decks, and after one night there I unhooked my hammock and put it on what was known as the dog deck. The dog deck is at the aft of the ship, where there's a deck above it, but it's open because it's where they throw off all the refuse. But I managed to sling my hammock at this area. I had fresh air, more space, and I was much happier. Others then began to find places in other parts of the ship, and we weren't interfered with. In the meantime, it's said that one should never volunteer, I volunteered to do a job serving on table. I did it for two reasons. One, to get away from some of the bullshit, and two, to have access to the best food. So I had a relatively cushy time, although there was an attempt to make those of us who had special jobs on the ship to join the others on parades. And as we sometimes worked odd hours, because we worked all meal times and we did some preparation before, but mainly in setting tables and clearing tables and serving the food, we thought we shouldn't go on parade. And there was a collective decision not to go on parade. Well, we had the riot act read to us, but they acceded to our request after reading the riot act, by threatening us with put us in irons and all that.
Did somebody tip you off about volunteering for this job?
No, I just used my loaf. I saw it was going and I thought, well, can't be worse than just idling. Although I had books to read, wherever I went I took books. And in the meantime also, by the Bush Telegraph, I had become acquainted with six other communists on the ship. Although there was one communist who was got a bit of white on his shoulder, who we knew of but never associated with us.
Who was he?
Well, he's a Dr. Len Jones, who's now a docent in the German Democratic Republic, although probably retired by now. He was a Liverpudlian Jewish person, Cambridge classics scholar, but I give him his due. He was teaching French, I think, in a secondary school in Liverpool. But he kept apart because he was officer training material, being ex-Cambridge. But the others came from Leeds, Bristol, London. And it was then that we began to discuss, I began to discuss politics with them. And it was in the course of the journey from Freetown to Cape Town that there was a small bulletin from the Sparks on board that Germany had invaded Russia. So I was one of the initiators, promptly called a meeting of the group. And the only place we could have meetings was on open deck. And there were literally 200 or 300 blokes sitting around us when we were discussing the war. In the meantime, of course, some of us were known through our activities as servants on the waiting on table and this sort of thing. And our attitude during the no parade period.
So did you call an open meeting?
I called an open... Well, it was a meeting of the six, but it was open in the sense that it was in a public place. It was on an open deck.
So they just happened to...
The rest just happened to be sitting around, you know.
They participate in the discussion?
No, they just listened. Those nearest they could hear listened. But I think it spread around that the communists were supporting the war. That was our decision. That while we privately maybe supported the war, as I had from June 40, we thought that the world communist movement would be now supporting the war. That was our conclusion. And when I went into Cape Town, the first day ashore, I spent with my friends just visiting bars. I persuaded someone to have a look in the odd workshop where we saw an open door, and we discussed with the foreman the work that was going on. I remember going into a furniture workshop and all the work was being done by natives, blacks, black people. The foreman was white. And from discussions I heard that he technically was the only skilled man there. But they were doing skilled work. But they were treated as unskilled people. He knew what they had to do and he told them what they had to do. But in fact, it was obvious that they were skilled people. But the bars were segregated. When we went on a tram, it was segregated. The next day, I had an introduction in my pocket because I took caution that if I did call at a port like Cape Town, I'd have somebody to visit. And I visited a communist woman who was the art editor of the Cape Times. Just recently, the editor of the Cape Times has been prosecuted, hasn't he?
I'm not sure.
Yes, he has. For it was a liberal paper. Well, just as the Times of India, the Cape Times, you know the sort of paper the Times of India was. So I went to, having had spent a day with the lads, as it were, I went to her flat. She had a palatial flat. I had a bath in a bathroom as big as a living room. But she was the art editor. She was well paid. And it was in the a lovely white quarter of Cape Town. But she took me, after having a bath and breakfast, second breakfast, to meet the editors, the editorial board of the Cape Guardian, which was then a... we'll term it a progressive paper, inspired by the Communist Party of South Africa, but had on it trade union and other people on the editorial board. And there I met one person who I met again in Mozambique, Ray Alexander, as she was known to me then, now Ray Simon, a leading member of the Communist Party of South Africa still, and the ANC, and is based in Lusaka. But she impressed me as a very... She was Jewish, had escaped from the Baltic republics when they were not... when they didn't become part of the Soviet Union. She'd gone to South Africa sometime in the late 20s or the early 30s. She was a woman of about my age. Then through her I met Moses Katana, who was the first black general secretary of the Communist Party of South Africa, and we exchanged a few ideas for 10 or 15 minutes, and he informed me that the Communist Party of South Africa had changed its attitude to the war.
What kind of a person was Moses Katana? Could you get any kind of personal impression of him?
Well, it was too short an interview to get a real impression. Although he was friendly, he was the typical thick, well-set South African Negro type, and in that sense friendly.
Where did you meet him exactly?
In the headquarters of the Communist Party of South Africa in Cape Town, in their office. Ray Alexander, who was a leading communist also, had, though one of the chief editors of this Cape Guardian, took me.
So they were operating legally then?
Oh yes, it was legal. And the white, well, the whites were very much in two camps then. As you probably know, all the Afrikaners who are of the Bota ilk were in concentration camps. Our concentration camps. Because they supported Hitler and had Hitler fascist ideas. Whereas the liberal Afrikaners and the English extract whites were pro-war. And every time a convoy came in, I was told, and this was our experience, there were fleets of cars at the dock gates picking up soldiers and taking them off home and giving them meals and baths and this sort of thing. I was very sorry to leave because of the contacts I made. It was only three to four days we were ashore, but they were very full days for me. And I kept contact through giving them money, and they, or rather, I gave them money, and then I sent an address from India, and I got the Cape Guardian most of the time I was in India, the 4 years I was there, which got to me quicker than papers from England, which used to take about 3 months.
What happened to you next?
We landed in Bombay, and we went through the traditional... I was being attached to the Indian Army, our detachment were, and the signal group went to Mau, in the state of Indore, as it was then, central India. At the dockside, we were issued with a derry, a sheet, and a mosquito net. And they were my possessions, personal possessions, for 4 years, probably a couple of sheets.
What happened to you at Mau?
We went through 6 months intensive technical training. I was trained as an operator. It was a beautiful barracks, in a beautiful situation, cantonment, and I had my first experience of racism. The regular soldiers treated the charwalas and the bearers as wogs.
In what way? How did it show
itself? My first indication of this was when the charwala came onto the veranda, and the particular NCO in charge of our barrack room, which by the way was palatial compared to a British barrack room, we even had punkah wallahs and the beds were well spaced, instead of 30 men to this huge barrack room, there'd probably be 10 of us. And the regular soldier just trekked the charwell as dirt, and if he was doing in the wrong spot, he'd just literally kick him off that spot and tell him to go somewhere else. And yet, we had absolute service. We had a flying dhobi for about equivalent of about 1 and 6 pence, a rupee a week. Rupee then was about 1 and 6 pence in 1941. I mean, a good English 1 and 6 pence. And we could be shaved in bed for a few hours. Go to the canteen, you had bearer service. Not like the naffy in England. So we were, just by virtue of being given this privileged treatment, we were being separated from the Indians.
Did the conscripts share the racism?
Some of them did. But I think because of those of us who didn't share this racism, I saw a gradual change in my companions in the course of the period. Some of my companions that went to India with me, at least a dozen, were in the division that I eventually went to, so I saw them over 4 years. And I think it's largely personal example. If they have the wrong example, they follow that. If they have the right example, or they've got two examples, they can, I think on balance, they can choose the right one. But I think it's important that people give the right example.
Anything else happened up now that we should mention?
No, just that we had this privileged time. We trained up to about 4 o'clock, then I would play hockey or football, then we'd shower, and the complete change every day of clothing, which was taken away and replaced every day with a new clean set. I mean, as I took devices myself of one set, I had another set to put on, and we just had an enjoyable, privileged 6 months training there. And then we were shipped to Quetta, or rather, entrained to Quetta, right on the Afghan border.
What happened there?
There, that was the headquarters, General Staff headquarters of the 14th Indian Division. The general at that time was General Ritchie, and he was a desert man. We, after this initial mobilization at Quetta, we moved down to a railway junction called Sibi, which is in the Sindh Desert, on the edge of the Sindh Desert. I was attached to the General's Line Communication Office, which is the main office of a general at the GHQ. The brigades were doing their own, everybody was doing their own thing. We had a brigade of Gurkhas. We had a mixed brigade. The tradition then was if we had a brigade of Indian troops, it was really only two battalions of Indian troops and one English battalion. That's how they organized it in those days. So we had two Indian brigades, but strengthening those Indian brigades were English battalions, whereas the Gurkha brigade was a complete Gurkha brigade, as you probably know. The officers are English. And there's this very strong relationship between their officers and the very disciplined Gurkha troops.
What was your own personal attitude towards the Gurkhas?
I found them just like very obedient and very strong and very courteous, because orderlies would come to our signal office, Gurkha orderlies, and very technically, militarily correct relationship. Some of the Indian troops were much more relaxed, especially the technical troops.
Relaxed in what way?
In the sense of their relationship, whereas I get the impression the Gurkhas treated the white man as a kind of god. I think they were trained and conditioned to look up to their, and they treated all whites, even if we were NCOs or signalmen.
Deferentially, you mean?
Deferentially, and as if we were officers.
In what way would the other Indian troops be less deferential then?
Well, they weren't less deferential, but I see certainly in the signals we had a much more relaxed attitude. All technical troops are very different. I found the signals very different from the, or different to the infantry. And our NCOs, corporals, sergeants, differed in the sense that they were technical men. Although some, we'd still had CSMs and RSMs who had responsibility for discipline, but the discipline was very different, very different. However, during that short period in the Sindh Desert, we were given orders. Our commander-in-chief then would be Wavell, based in Delhi. There was an order to reorganize our division into two divisions. General Ritchie took the Gurkha brigade, and I believe he had attached to him two new brigades, and they would eventually go to the desert, because Ritchie appeared in desert news later on. We received, although I must confess I forget his name, and I haven't any record of his name, we received a general who was a Burma general, or had been in Southeast Asia, but had managed to get out when Burma, Malaya, and those countries fell to the Japanese. So we became a division that was designated to go to the defense of India, and we entrained at Sibi and went via on a very long train journey. I don't know if the train journey interests you.
Yes.
Well, it was a special military train for the headquarter personnel, mainly the clerks, the ordnance, all the departments of a headquarters, the medics. Not the general and the colonels, I think they went separately, but we, from our officers and men, were on this train, and it took us about a week to get to Ranchi, which is in Bihar. But it took this time because at every meal time, we would stop at a station and the Royal Indian Army Service Corps would have a meal waiting for us. We'd have a meal, we'd have a little exercise by walking around the village, if there was a village adjacent to the station, and then at the clang of a bell, we'd get back on board the train and proceed. And this went on for 7 days. And at Ranchi, we were re-equipped as a division with vehicles and so forth. We then moved off by vehicle from Ranchi to Calcutta, we didn't stay in Calcutta, we eventually landed at Comilla, which is now the eastern extremity of Bangladesh, but was then adjacent to the state of Tripura, which was in Bengal but now is in Assam, in the reorganized independent India.
Or actually, independent states.
Well, Tripura is part of Assam. Well, it was an independent state, but nominally with Bengal at that point in time. And we had the Tripura Rifles as a kind of auxiliary to our division. The division had the area from Chittagong and the Chittagong tracts up to the Burma border, Feni. I don't know if you know the area.
Yes.
That was our area in 1942, and the most two interesting things happened to me and Camilla, or happened to one. I discovered an Indian club that had an excellent library, and while War and Peace of Tolstoy had been on my reading list for a long time, I borrowed it from that library and read it in the signal office when I was not busy. I visited that club, and I was the first white person ever to honour them, as they said, with a visit.
Why was that?
Because of the caste system was stronger in the British Army. The judges had their clubs, and the military had their clubs, and the civilian jute wallers had their clubs, and so forth and so on. But they didn't mix with the Indians. The only people who mixed with Indians were cosmopolitans. I discovered this when I went to Calcutta, but I can deal with that later. But I talked to local doctors, lawyers, businessmen in this club. It was the local intelligentsia, if we can put it that way, and with this fine English library. And they confessed they've learnt their love of freedom from Byron and Shelley and English literature. So I had many conversations of that kind, because, again, having been a bookseller and a great reader, I found them interesting people to talk to, perhaps more interesting than my own officers or sergeants. Then I had a call from my section captain, who was an ex-regular soldier and had been commissioned in the field. He was a captain now, but he was a sergeant instructor at Mao when I was there, but he'd been promoted to captain practically overnight. And he said, "Hall, are you a communist?" And I said, "Yes." He says, "Well, you're probably going to get kicked out of the army." I said, "Good." Then he asked me if I'd been in this club, and he said that they'd had a report of my conversations in the club. And I just didn't deny anything that I'd said. I stood by what I said. I think I had said to them that I couldn't understand why the Congress didn't allow their young men to join the Indian Army. I said they would outnumber us, and we would be in a very weak position. That was just one of the many things, but I discussed mainly Indian Congress politics, because in 1942, whilst at Camilla, there was a Hartal.
This was part of the Quit India movement, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes. It was the strongest Hartal that we'd ever experienced, I'd ever experienced. And all the Congress leaders were in prison. And I got all this information from conversations with my Congress friends. And at that time, I had no idea of a man called